Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you want to download it or put it on your iPod or sit in front of your computer. Today we have an excellent show as we bring Mike Lackey from Mayer Brown back to do another ESI Bytes program. Mike and I were talking 2 weeks ago when I was in Washington, D.C. about how federal circuits are handling spoliation standards differently, as evidenced by Judge Shira Shinlin's opinion in the Pension Committee case in the Second Circuit at the beginning of the year versus the Rimkus Consulting Group case, which came out in the Fifth Circuit after Pension Committee and authored by also a very prominent judge, Lee Rosenthal, in the Fifth Circuit. And on top of that, we're talking about the issue of appealing decisions in e-discovery and the challenges that faces. We wrapped up that discussion, of course, with the time of year it is, with trying to dissect the NCAA tournament. And the only thing we know today about all these topics, which is different from then, is that Kentucky will not win the NCAA tournament. And while Mike is still in mourning, he's pulled himself together to the podcast. Mike, you're right. Can we continue with the show?
I guess so. The only thing that makes it worse is Duke is still in there. But I guess I'll muddle through.
Okay. Well, some background information on Mike Lackey is he serves on Mayer Brown's partnership board. He co-chairs the firm's electronic discovery and records management practice. He leads the Washington, D.C. office's litigation practice, and he chairs the firm's electronic discovery support group. Mike's practice focuses on civil and criminal litigation and electronic discovery. He's nationally recognized for his knowledge of electronic discovery issues. He serves as a member of the Board of Advisors to the Georgetown University Law School Advanced E-Discovery Institute, and he's a co-author of the PLI Electronic Discovery Desk Book. The other interesting thing about Mike is he's in very rare company here, since he both graduated from the prestigious Top Gun School and also flew F-14 fighter jets, and has a degree in aeronautical and astronautical engineering from MIT, which I think is a pretty neat set of skills. So Mike, thanks for coming on the show. And you know, starting off, what's harder to predict, the NCAA tournament or developing an effective litigation hold strategy? Which is harder?
Well, that's a great question. Well, I can just tell you this much. I certainly did not have Butler and Michigan State playing in that side of the bracket. So maybe we better stick to the litigation hold strategy.
Yeah, you know, if I'm Butler, I'm asking Gene Hackman to come to the Final Four and putting him on the right there on the bench.
Absolutely.
Anyway, all right, well, why don't we start on the topic here? Why don't you provide sort of a brief overview of the Pension Committee case? We'll contrast these two cases we're going to talk about.
Sure. Pension Committee, as you noted, was authored by Judge Shira Shinlin out of the Southern District of New York. And as you also noted, she's a very preeminent jurist in the electronic discovery field who gained a lot of acclaim with her initial series of opinions in Zubelake. It's something interesting about Pension Committee when you call it up or you're looking at it. The opinion originally issued on January 11th, and then Judge Shinlin amended it with some important changes on January 15th of this year. A couple things. Bottom line is, it's a big case, and that's kind of important to the proportionality analysis you want to recall. It has to do with losses totaling about $550 million from the liquidation of hedge funds in which the plaintiffs had held shares. The court at the end of the day granted in part defendant's motion for sanctions. So an interesting thing about this case and Rimkus actually is the sanctions are being imposed against plaintiffs, which is contrary to what you normally think how these cases play out. Important holding in the court is that the plaintiffs essentially did not act diligently and search thoroughly when they reasonably should have anticipated litigation. An important part there, this is not a case of willful destruction. It's a case, as Judge Shinlin says, of gross negligence. And so that's very important for the subsequent analysis as far as the appropriate sanctions and what the plaintiffs had to show. And to give you a flavor for the kind of gross negligence that the court found is, she said that during discovery, defendants noticed that there were substantial gaps. There was discovery about discovery going on from October 2007 through June 2008. She said that An important point also is that the defendants moved for sanctions on only 13 of the 96 plaintiffs, so they were very selective in who they went after with very specific allegations. And the allegations were that they failed to preserve and produce documents, and they submitted false and misleading declarations. And I think the false and misleading declarations are also a very important part of the story in Pynchon Committee. At the end of the day, as I mentioned, the court found that that six plaintiffs of the 13 were grossly negligent, and that she imposed an adverse inference instruction, which basically allowed the jury, she number one instructed the jury that the plaintiffs were grossly negligent and allowed the jury to presume that the documents that were not produced were both relevant and prejudicial to the plaintiffs. So a very important decision that's obtained a lot of press and ink, and it kind of takes us the next step in this sanctions realm.
Yeah, so now let's contrast that with the Rimpis case. How did that differ, and some facts on that case as well?
Yeah, Rimpis is a very different case, and as you noted, it came from Judge Lee Rosenthal, who sits on the committee that's responsible for the federal rules. So again, another eDiscovery superstar who's very well known in this space and very knowledgeable. Rimpis, interestingly enough, opposite of Pynchon Committee, number one, is a small case. Smaller. It's not a $550 million case, but basically has to do with like covenants not to compete, things like that. Second, Rimpis involves willful destruction. So although a smaller case, it's higher on the culpability scale. That also plays in. Interestingly, though, Judge Rosenthal says that under the Fifth Circuit's rule, the defendant still had to show relevance and prejudice before they could get the kind of severe sanction of an adverse inference. And so a very different standard applied. And what's very interesting about the Rimpis case, and I commend it to everyone to read, because she does a wonderful job of laying out the state of the law in the various circuits. And what's fascinating about it, and what you and I talked about, is how the law really differs depending on where you sit, which is obviously the kind of thing that we try to avoid in the judicial system. But right now, with respect to what a party has to show in order to obtain a severe sanction, really differs depending on where you are. And it's very problematic because a lot of these decisions are not susceptible to immediate review and may never get reviewed because they are discovery rulings early in a case. So it's very interesting when you look at the two cases, and they really illustrate how the different circuits are approaching the problem.
I guess it becomes even more challenging if you're in one of the circuits that hasn't come clearly out on this issue. Are they going to go left? Are they going to go right?
You're absolutely right. Judge Rosenthal did a fabulous job of kind of outlining where the circuits were, and this is a relatively recent opinion, came down in the middle of February. And basically, she put together in grouping. She said in the First, Fourth, and Ninth Circuit, if there's very bad prejudice, then you don't have to show bad faith to get a severe sanction. And just to be clear, when we're talking about a severe sanction, you're essentially talking about a default judgment, striking the pleadings, or an adverse inference. And in most of these cases, it's going to be an adverse inference. She noted in the Third Circuit, it's basically a balancing test where you balance how culpable the party was with the prejudice to the other party. She noted that in the 7th, 8th, 10th, 11th, and D.C. Circuit, you need a showing of bad faith before you can get those most severe sanctions. And in the 5th, she said that she didn't really have to address that particular issue because in her particular case, there was willful destruction. And willful destruction was enough for her to go ahead and impose the most severe sanction. And she noted in the Second Circuit, which is a bit of an outlier when you kind of heard that summary right there, is that there is a case, residential funding, that allows you to impose an adverse inference on a finding of negligence, which does appear to be an outlier, but Judge Shenlin in Pynchon Committee, as Judge Rosenthal pointed out, was applying Second Circuit law. So you can kind of see through across the country, the circuits have pretty well settled. I didn't do a quick lineup there. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I guess the 6th Circuit hasn't weighed in, and the 9th, but the 7th, 8th, 10th, 11th, and the D.C. Circuit have all weighed in. So as we would say in the appellate practice area, we have a deep and abiding split The problem is this is the kind of issue that could probably very difficult to get to the Supreme Court.
Is there anything really bad about having splits? And talk to me as a litigator in this space. What are the challenges this causes for you?
Well, it's obviously a challenge, and that it's not how you want the legal system to operate. Indeed, that's the entire purpose of the Supreme Court, is to make sure that the laws that apply to a litigator sitting in New York are the same laws that apply to a litigator sitting in California or Texas, and that's just not the case right now. You want a consistent rule of law so that the parties understand what their obligations are and what the ramifications for failing to comply with those obligations are, which is what you really have in the spoliation context. So it's not the ideal situation. Indeed, it's the kind of situation you do not want broadly. As far as you want uniformity of laws across the country, and we just don't have that right now in this area. And it's very important. It's not an academic point, because as you can well imagine, when the documents are lost, a critical issue is who is going to have the burden to show, number one, that the documents were relevant, so it matters, if you will, and second, that the documents were prejudicial. And that's difficult. It's kind of the old, it's the cart and the horse here. How do you do that when you don't know what was lost?
I guess with forum shopping.
In some of these cases, they've been able to retrieve some of the deleted documents by restoring backup tapes. And indeed, in Remkes, they were able to do that. They were able to cobble together some of the lost documents along with some deposition testimony and, as the court described, quote-unquote, circumstantial evidence, and find that both relevance and prejudice were shown. But many times that's not the case. So where the presumption lies, if you will, or who has the burden, can be dispositive.
And it's not like you can forum shop on this unless you know going into the case that you're going to have a problem retrieving documents.
Yeah, no, that's right. Although, if you think about it, let's say I'm a plaintiff's lawyer and I've got a big class action and it's going to be filed in states all across the country and it's going to go to a multi-district proceeding. When you have that kind of case, that basically the cases get transferred for pretrial proceeding, you could argue for a jurisdiction in which those spoliation claims are easier to show. I'm not saying you would. There's lots of factors that would go into that, the substantive law, convenience of the parties, lots of different factors. But this is another one that an attorney might consider when trying to decide where they would like a case venued.
Although plaintiffs aren't immune from this, as both of these cases show.
Yeah, that's the irony that we all talk about. The two most recent cases involve plaintiffs. So you're exactly right. It shouldn't be thought of in terms of plaintiffs and defendants. The only reason I mentioned plaintiffs before, they're the ones bringing those cases. So a defendant could also try to steer it to a jurisdiction in an MDL argument that they believe would be most beneficial for how they believe the case is going to play out. If they believe, for example, the plaintiffs are going to have serious spoliation issues, then they may prefer a jurisdiction in which it's easier to prove those claims. But as you point out, at the beginning of a lawsuit, you have no idea how it's going to play out.
Well, let's leave the real world, okay? We have two of the real stars, judges, coming down with decisions that go in different directions. But let's work with a hypothetical here. Suppose you have a judge who's not sophisticated in the workings of e-discovery, and they issue an opinion which many agree is incorrect. What's the next step in the real world, if we take this issue and talk about, the impact of bad decisions in e-discovery?
Well, it's an adverse inference settle. Here's one of the problems. I say that half jokingly, but it's difficult to try a case if you're going to get a really adverse jury instruction. The jury's going to think you're being told by the court that you're essentially a bad actor. And in pinching committee, Judge Shenlin instructed the jury that the plaintiffs were grossly negligent. So that's going to impact your ability to persuade that jury that your party is entitled to recover in that particular case. Well, here's the problem you have, is that most of these rulings, they're evidentiary rulings. You're not going to be able to get, it's going to be very difficult to get immediate appellate review. A mandamus probably isn't going to work. You're not entitled to immediate appellate review of this kind of decision. And so what's going to happen is you're going to have to, unless, of course, you get a default judgment or something like that ends the case, then obviously you can get that up on review pretty quickly. But most of these cases involve adverse inferences. So what you have to do at that point is you have to live with that ruling and continue to litigate the case through the end, which means through a likely trial or if you were able to prevail on a motion for summary judgment. But you basically have to live with that ruling, litigate the case, get to the end, and then try to get appellate review. And as I noted earlier, that's a long road and a difficult road, and a lot of things happen between this kind of ruling and the resolution of a case. For example, settlement. This could greatly impact the settlement value of a particular case, and if you do end up settling and having to pay more because you're concerned about this adverse inference, then you're never going to get any kind of appellate review of this. And even if you do go all the way through trial, maybe you win at trial, and then obviously that's not such a big issue, but if you lose at trial, this is going to be one of the issues you're going to raise on appeal. And it's difficult to see how that's going to play out, but it can greatly influence the course of a litigation, and it may not get effective review. And that's one of the reasons I think you're seeing this split of authority that is evolving out there among the district courts, is that it's difficult to get this question squarely before the Supreme Court where they could resolve what the standard is.
And it's not the first time this has happened in this field. I mean, I think back to Grimm's decision in Hopkins v. City of Baltimore, where he outlaid all the problems with privilege and privilege waiver, and then Rule 502 was put in place to try to address some of these issues.
You raise a good point, is that a lot of times a better course, when you can't get cases up to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court doesn't have an opportunity to resolve these issues, is some kind of rulemaking resolution. Of course, that has its own issues. I know the Rules Committee is very concerned about the breadth of its jurisdiction with respect to when you're looking at this particular issue. For example, in Remkes, you're looking in the federal courts at the court's inherent power, and you're looking at also Rule 37 to the extent that comes into play, Federal Rule Civil Procedure 37 on sanctions. But query whether or not this is an issue you could solve through the rulemaking process. And if you do, as you point out, I mean, they don't meet that frequently. It takes a while for these things to get resolved if you could enact a kind of rule that would address this. So it's a difficult problem. It's something we're living with right now, and I don't see any immediate resolution in sight.
Well, you're a creative guy, Mike. You're a Top Gun, an engineer. Surely you've got to have a I like having smart people on the show because you get to answer the tough questions. Do we need an active Supreme Court in this area, or, you know, do you think the rulemaking committee has to be active? Because
yeah.
Appeals aren't going to come in this area. I mean, people are fighting the case. When the case ends, well, who cares about the e-discovery?
Yeah.
For everyone else. I'm not going to, you know.
No, you're absolutely right. That's the problem, I think, Carl, is that I think it's going to be difficult to get one of these cases up before the Supreme Court. And you, once you get it up there, I think you have a deep and abiding split. So I think it is the kind of issue, and it's important, an adverse inference can effectively end a case. So I believe if you could get a case up there, it's a case the Supreme Court would be very interested in hearing. It's the kind of case, resolving splits across the country, that they typically take on important issues. But as you note, I think it's going to be difficult to get a case up there. So litigants out there who may be listening, if you have the appropriate case and you have lost essentially because of an adverse inference instruction and you've taken it through the jury verdict and you didn't settle, then you may want to go ahead and press this up to the Supreme Court, because I think you would have a decent likelihood of getting a grant. I think it's an important issue. I think you would also see a lot of amici come in from the different areas, because this is an important issue and can be case dispositive in big cases. So I think there would be a tremendous amount of interest. The problem is, again, getting a case all the way through a jury trial in the appropriate posture, then going through the Court of Appeals and getting it up. So you're talking a multi-year process. And the Rules Committee, as you know, is a multi-year process as well. So, as I say, I see no, being a creative guy and everything else, I just don't see any immediate solution to the problem that we're now confronting as litigants in the different circuits.
Maybe we need you to offer to all people angry at this situation that want to get it resolved that you know, that Mike Lackey will go pro bono to take this to the Supreme Court.
You know, we probably would take something like that. You know, we obviously have a very substantial Supreme Court and appellate practice here at Mayor Brown, and this is the kind of case I think we'd be very interested in.
It's a neat issue. Well, I do appreciate you coming on board for the show. I thought it was a great topic and wanted to do it right away after we talked about it a couple weeks ago. So, you know, keep these thoughts coming. I'm always happy to do these shows with you, Mike. And, you know, I want to thank you for joining us on another show. And hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows later this year.
Carl, it's always a pleasure and appreciate it.
To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our shows. You can also go to EDRM's website, where we're listed as a resource. However you choose to remember us, come back to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shineman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.